As if to prove that things are going to be different in Minnesota, Governor Jesse Ventura showed up at his inaugural ball in leather fringe, a Jimi Hendrix t-shirt, a bandana, and earrings. His stunning triumph last fall captured the imagination of the country, if not the world. Almost overnight, the former professional wrestler has become the most talked about politician of the day. In the ring, he was Jesse the body. In the governor's office, he has proclaimed himself Jesse the mind. But Ventura seems to spend nearly as much time fending off requests for appearances on Leno and Letterman as he does leading his state. How the Reform Party candidate won is part of his mystique. Outspent 3-1 by both his Republican and Democratic rivals, the latter the son of the late Vice President Hubert Humphrey, Ventura blew them away in the final weeks of the campaign with his plain-talking, common-sense approach. But most of the mania is about who Ventura is. In the early 1970s, he was a U.S. Navy SEAL and then a member of a California motorcycle gang. But he was also a nearly straight-A student at North Hennepin Community College before he used his brawn and machismo to win a role as a bad guy on the pro wrestling circuit. Jesse the Body quickly became a hero to children across the country. After retiring from the ring in 1984, Ventura turned to the silver screen. He had roles in 9 motion pictures, starring with Arnold Schwarzenegger in Predator, the movie in which a wounded Ventura uttered, "I ain't got time to bleed." Ventura also became a radio talk show host. In 1990, angered about the threatened destruction of a wetland, he ran for and won a 4-year term as mayor of the Minneapolis suburb of Brooklyn Park. He must have enjoyed governing. His new challenge of heading a 3-party government, Democrats control Minnesota Senate, Republicans control the House, and he's in the governor's mansion, is a daunting task. Still, Ventura is off to a flying start. Despite his controversial stance on social policies that crisscross the political spectrum, his approval rating has soared above 70%. Jesse Ventura action figures are selling like crazy. But as he makes his first appearance here at the National Press Club, the honeymoon may already be over. He referred to the press room at the state capitol as, quote, a rat-infested basement, unquote. He proposed cutting funding for Minnesota Public Radio, and he recently invited a reporter to accompany him on a hunting trip, promising to give the reporter a 100-foot head start. I don't know what's in our basement, but from the top floor of the National Press Building, ladies and gentlemen, please join in giving a warm National Press Club welcome to Governor Jesse Ventura.
Thank you. That's a tough act to follow. Distinguished guests at the front table, the head table, thank you very much. It's my honor to be here at the National Press Club, as well as to my fan club. I welcome you here. It's okay, you can laugh. And don't feel bad about it. I say that to my press in Minnesota quite often. You can laugh. It's all right to do it. In fact, it's gotten to the point now with the press that when I say a joke, I look out them at them and say, that was a joke, so that they understand it. But I had a couple... That one even surprised me. It's fun. I will tell you that right now, being governor of the state of Minnesota. There's not a day that I don't get up and enjoy going to work. And I can't say that about every job I've had, but right now I can about being governor. And I'm destroying some of the myths that I had about what it's like to serve as a governor of the state of Minnesota. I used to always sit back kind of cynically when they gave an honorary degree to a politician, you know, be it whatever university it was from, would give them an honorary degree. Well, I've taken it to show you I can handle change. I've changed my mind on that, because after the last 3 months or so, I realized that truly there is no university in our great country that could teach you what I'm learning on the job as the governor of the state of Minnesota. So Harvard and Yale, if you're listening out there, when I'm done, I wouldn't mind one. How did I get here? Well, it was an interesting road how I got here to stand up here in front of you all, one of the most famous, I guess you'd call it lecture circuits. What would it be called here? Speaking engagements in the world right here. I did serve as mayor of Twin City suburb of Brooklyn Park, Minnesota from 1991 to 1995 and then left politics feeling that I would never again return to it because I am a believer very strongly that our country was founded upon the fact people coming, serving, and then going back to what you used to do, a lost art today, because they don't do that very often, go back to what they used to do. And I think that I can reinforce that decision over how truly easy it is to sit where I sit today. And when I say that, I mean only in qualifying to do it. All it says is be over the age of 25 and live in the state 1 year. And you're qualified to be the governor of the state of Minnesota. Now, why is that? It's that way because our forefathers wanted each and every one of us to potentially have the qualifications to lead a state or, for that matter, to lead the United States of America. They did not say you had to have a degree in this, a degree in that, be a doctorate of this or whatever, because I believe that's what our country was founded upon was citizens governing, and that's where I come from. And I came in, I wasn't going to seek office ever again after being mayor until Minnesota acquired a very large budget surplus that the career politicians chose to spend rather than giving it back. All while the time my property taxes were rising on the rate of about $460 a year for 4 to 5 consecutive years in a row. And I felt the call again. Someone had to go stop the madness. And that's someone you're looking at. So about a year and a half ago, we met in my barn over my wife's objections. And Dean Barkley and Doug Friedline and myself, a core group of the Reform Party, of which I'll back up a moment. How did I get involved in the Reform Party? Maybe I should state that for a moment. How did that happen? It wasn't by my choice. The other two parties made the choice. They made the call, and I abided by it. They made it because when I ran for mayor, it was a nonpartisan election. Now, for those that don't know, that means there's no parties involved. After all, I am speaking to reporters, aren't I? Oh, I forgot, my fan club. Nonpartisan, anyway. So there's no parties involved. Yet when I ran for mayor in this election, the Democrats and Republicans saw fit to join forces and send a letter to every citizen in Brooklyn Park stating they were uniting behind the 20-year incumbent mayor, that this was the most important election in the city of Brooklyn Park, and they then called me the most dangerous man in the city. Now, as a Navy SEAL, I thought, how did they know that about me? How dangerous we truly can be. But that was 20 years ago. And I didn't mind that they lined up opposing me. The election took place, and I won all 21 precincts, won 65% to 35% against a united front by the two parties. But the thing that bothered me the most was when that election was over, at that point, both parties independently then came courting me. Imagine, they now wanted the most dangerous man in the city. And what did I learn from that? I learned that the end justifies the means. And I learned that these two parties have no credibility because it didn't matter what you stood for as long as you won. That was the important thing. Then they would wholeheartedly welcome you in. Well, I said, no, thank you. I'll continue on. And then I started seeing this candidate, Dean Barkley, with the Reform Party. Who's this Reform Party? Used to be the Independence Party. So we were here before Perot in Minnesota. And then in 92, when the Perot movement happened, the Independence Party combined with the Perot followers and created the Reform Party. And I felt that this was a party I could fit into much better because the fact is I can be me. My opinion, the other two parties, you have to become them. You have to change who you are and fit into their two narrow agendas on the far left and the far right to become part of them and to achieve success. The Reform Party didn't require that of me. They allowed me to be me. And so I finished my term as mayor and had no designs on returning to government again. I felt I had served, go back to the private sector, do what you used to do. Then the surplus. Now we're back to where we were with the surplus. I'll get you back there. And when that happened, I started thinking, I have to answer the call again. And I feel very strongly that the rise of a third party is important to our country for a number of reasons. First of all, why should we get only two choices, two major choices? Again, I believe you have the far left at 15%, you have the far right at 15%, and there's 70% of us in the center. This is called centrist. Write it down. There's 70% of us in the center that are then forced to make a choice between the left and the right because we're not given a candidate where we feel in the middle that can take the best of the right and the best of the left. So we felt strongly, what would it take to win? We felt we needed to be polling the mid-20s by the election. We felt we needed to get $400,000 to be able to spend enough and saturate the market the last 2 to 3 weeks to pull this off, to win. We never once went into this thinking, show well, get a message across. I can tell you from day one, I went into this race to win. I don't do anything not to win. And we achieved those goals because as time got closer and closer, I started off in the polls. Mr. Humphrey had 46%. The Democrat, Mr. Coleman, had about 32, 33, the Republican, and Jesse Ventura was at 10%. But I didn't believe the polls because we also knew two other things we had to make happen. Number one, we had to entice the disenchanted voter back. Why is he disenchanted? The Democrats and Republicans. That's why. We had to give that disenchanted voter a reason to come back to the polls, and we did that. Number two, we had to get the young people. And bear in mind, both of these two elements are not polled generally. They don't fit into the polling results. So we knew. And we did that. We sent a message. We focused on young people. We focused on disenchanted voters. And then there was a fatal mistake made by both parties. On the Democrats at the primary, they said, and it was a good mistake. It was an honorable mistake. Let me say that. The Democrats came out and said they would not debate unless I was in it. I had earned the right to be there. We had major party status, and I should be there. That was the ethical good thing to do. But as far as tactics for an election, that was the worst thing they could have done. And I knew it. Second of all, the Republican candidate, when these debates got going, at the end of his speeches all the time, he would turn to the people and say, if you vote for Jesse Ventura, you're wasting your vote. He can't win. Well, don't tell that to Minnesotans. And that was a major mistake because I think it was arrogant to make statements like that, telling someone voting for the candidate of your choice is a wasted vote. A wasted vote is not voting your conscience and your heart. That's a wasted vote. And lo and behold, I'll check my watch, too. I realize, about 1:30? Was that it, 1:30? Okay. Well, everything fell into place, and I'll always remember the night of the election. We kept rising in the polls. Mr. Coleman stayed the same, never varied, about 32, 33%. Mr. Humphrey was falling. And the night of the election, my wife, my son, and my daughter and I were driving to Canterbury Downs, where we held our election party that night. I thought it was very appropriate. A racetrack where long shots come in and win and pay off big. And as we were driving there, the moon was full. There was kind of a glow around it, and there was almost northern lights, about three of them, right, Terry, coming down from the moon. And my 19-year-old son looked at me and says, Dad, something strange is going to happen tonight. And it did. Because at 5% of the race, we took the lead when 5% were in. And, you know, I declared victory right there. Not that I, no, Not that I was going to win. I declared victory in the fact that no matter what happens now, they can't take from me, I led. I actually had the lead. Well, the lead widened, and it got bigger and bigger until at 60%, they asked me to go out and address the crowd one more time. I had been out there twice. I said, I don't want to do that. I'll be repeating myself, but the problem was I had the first campaign in history that had an active mosh pit going. For those that don't know what that is, that's what young people do when they pick up bodies and pass them around on top at arm's length. And we had a pretty good one going out there with a lot of young people, and they felt I needed to get them under control a little more. Well, it was so strange because as I stood up with 60% of the vote in and I started to go out, we had the three TV cameras on in the private room, and up came the first check mark. I was declared the winner. And I didn't believe it, because not one expert, not one pundit declared that I could win, not one poll said I could win, and now with 40% of Minnesotans not even counted, they were calling me the winner. I didn't believe it. I said, I'm not going out there and declaring victory. Look how embarrassed I'll be if 20% later I'm back in third, you know. But Bill Hilsman, the guy who did my award-winning ads, came up to me. Bill's a quiet guy, and he said, Governor, he said, you believed me on the ads, didn't you? And I said, yes, I did. He said, then believe me now. You are the governor. And I said, Bill, how can this be? 40% is still out there. He said, trust me, they haven't been wrong since Dewey and Truman. Which was, I think, exactly about 50 years earlier. So I became the governor. And I want to say this, thanks to you, the press throughout the world, of saying, what has Minnesota done? What is going on up there? Well, that was our rallying cry to Minnesotans. We circled the wagons. And forward to me came some of the best minds Minnesota has to offer, and believe me, we have a lot of them up there. Because they came forward to me with the same message that I then came forward with, was, I will not fail, I must not fail, and I cannot fail. Because if I do, we will lose these young people. These young people that entrusted themselves to us to go out there and give a little bit of honesty. To not be afraid in a big debate like I was in and was asked a question, and I created the biggest mistake you can as a political candidate. When the question was asked, I replied, I don't know. You can't do that, can you? You have to give 3 minutes of rhetoric to where you talk around and about and learn how to do all this, and in the end everyone says, he didn't even answer the question. That's what I stayed away from. I gave them plain talk and honesty. And that's what the people of Minnesota responded to. I gave them a centrist position, something far different than they were used to seeing. And it was amazing because here in Washington, we marked a new beginning. There was a caucus the other day of two independent governors. We held it out in the park. While the Republicans were meeting and the Democrats were meeting, Angus King of Maine and I were out in the park meeting. But we had tremendous press there, and we told them, you're here, a new beginning. You're part of a first, the independent tripartisan governors. But what was amazing was, as Angus spoke to them, Minnesota reporters were there, and they asked Angus some of the same questions they asked me, and the answers were identical. And we didn't even talk policy. His answers were the same as mine. So it's going to happen. If these two parties don't wake up from their bipartisan bickering and everything that they do, there will be more Jesse Venturas on the horizon. Rest assured of that, but that's not bad. We moved ahead then. We faced a unique situation. Reform Party candidates had run before, but they had never won. And the day after the election, we all looked at each other and says, my God, what the hell do we do now? We've won. What do you do? We didn't know. And so on board came my wife's best friend, a lady named Shirley Chase, a lawyer, a former CEO, independently wealthy, retired now at about age 42 or 43. And someone with a terrific mind, she came on board and started organizing, and even she said, this is too big for me. She then called a close friend, someone you're probably very familiar with out here, and out of the box, I call him Democrat, but I really think he was caught up in it. There was no other choice when he was here. A congressman named Tim Penny. And we called Tim, Shirley did, and said, what do? We have a new governor. Where do we go from here? And he recommended to me the gentleman sitting three seats down, Steve Bosacker, who was Tim's chief of staff and who was currently the chief of staff of the Board of Regents of the state of Minnesota and had just gone through the transition of University President Mark Udoff from Minnesota to Texas. So we brought a man on. Steve and I met, and I do things very much by gut reaction. And when I met Steve, I knew I wanted him to be my chief of staff, so away we went. I'm proud to say that we were under the gun to put out a biannual budget, two-year budget to the state of Minnesota. Most important document I think that any government does is spend people's money. It has to be the most important document. We were required to get this budget out, I believe, by February the 16th. I'm proud to say I submitted my budget January 28th. And let me tell you what went into that budget. No lobbyists, no special interest had my ear. I come with no strings attached. Because I didn't have to. They didn't buy me into office, so therefore I don't have to listen to them now. We came with a few principles, and I think you'll see them. They were supposed to be spread out today. If not, they're up here at the front table, these little cards. These are my principles. We hand them out, and this is our beliefs. And that's what went into our budget, not lobbyists, not their money. We haven't shut the door on them. I don't personally meet with them because I've had requests for over 200. I haven't met with one because if I meet with one, then I got to meet with 200. I have more important things to do. But we have told them a message. Yes, you can meet with my staff, but don't bring us money. Bring us good ideas. We'll be happy to use those good ideas. We don't want your money. And that's the new government that I'm instilling into the state of Minnesota, is the fact that we will answer to the people of Minnesota, that we will come in again with no strings attached to us. And I'm free to make decisions because guess what? If I do seek re-election 4 years from now, which I haven't decided yet, I'll already tell you what my campaign will be. It'll be simply, if you think I've done a good job, re-elect me. If you don't, elect someone else, and I'll be happy to go back to the private sector where I came from. Novel, huh? You won't see me out begging for this job and making promise after promise. During the election, I wouldn't make promises because I didn't feel knowledgeable enough many times to know whether I could keep them or not. And my integrity came first over promises. I did not want to make promises that later on I would find out I couldn't keep. But that's what we bring to the state of Minnesota now. That's the budget we've put together, and I'm proud of that budget. And we're bringing something that I had to remind the vice president of today. Tripartisan, new word. You get in these talks and you hear them talk about bipartisan support, and I look across the aisle and Angus King and I lock eyes and we both wink at each other. Go, isn't it funny how they forget us? But the vice president apologized and said he'd do his best to remember that. And I'll open up for questions before I finish off, because I'm sure you'll get into many things that I will need to talk about on the political end. I was very pleased last night, my wife and I, to make our first trip to the White House. And it was exceptional. It humbles you. It makes you feel good you're an American. And as the night went on, we got into the East Room where dancing was taking place, and I saw the First Lady and the President dancing, and there was like this large space around them where, you know, no one was like violating their space. And I grabbed the First Lady's hand and I said, put your champagne down. I said, we're going to go dance right next to the President. And the First Lady, because when the hell might we ever get this chance to do it again? So we went out on the floor and we had a great time, and the president, when the song ended, the president came over and put his arm around my wife and I, both. No, he did. And the First Lady, and they started talking. I mean, really plain talk. It was so enjoyable to talk to them. And he asked me about Minnesota and what I was doing, and I told him that Mr. President, I said, I just signed my first proclamation Monday. Really, he said. I said, yes, I did my first proclamation to the Rolling Stones. They were in town Monday, and I was the first governor ever to declare Monday the 15th Rolling Stones Day in Minnesota. And the president and Mrs. Clinton were enthusiastic. They said, what were some of the whereases? And I said, well, the most important one was, whereas Keith Richards is 55 and still alive. It was very enjoyable, as I said, to go into the White House last night. It's a dream come true, and if my mother and father were alive today, I think they'd be very proud to know their son set foot in the White House with his wife and danced next to the president. And I'll finish with this. I did have one more little devious idea, and the First Lady said, don't you dare. I almost went out and tapped on the shoulder and cut in. But you know what? I truly believe, I think the president would have laughed and enjoyed it. I really do. I think he would have really, if I would have did that, but I didn't. So you always, in hindsight, look back and go, doggone it, what I should have did. But it was a great time, and I was honored, too. The band that played there, kind of a swing orchestra-type band of dancing, took a break, and you know how they'll talk to the crowd, and I was so proud when they said, you know, it's exciting for us to be here in the White House, exciting to be playing for all the governors, and the lead singer looked over and she says, and there's Jesse Ventura. It's not often you have that said when you're a guest at the White House. Thank you very much. I appreciate the time to be here and appreciate the honor of speaking here.
The guest speaker today at the National Press Club is Governor Jesse Ventura of Minnesota. It's now time for questions.
In honor of the fact that today is February 22nd, I will ask the obligatory George Washington question. Why did you have a picture of George Washington behind your desk when you were mayor of Brooklyn Park? And tell us what you think about George Washington.
Well, why did I have it there? I don't know. It was there before I got there. I didn't put it there. There was a picture of George Washington in the Brooklyn Park City Hall probably long before I ever moved there, I would assume. So I don't know why it was there. It was there. I didn't remove it. And what do I think of George Washington? About what I know about reading about him. I never met him. But he's the father of our country. This great city that we're in is named after him, so I can only assume he did a good job. And he also set the British packing, I think, which at that time was a good idea. We'll welcome the Stones, but we'll send their army back.
I've been inundated with the wrestling questions, but I'm only going to ask a couple of them here.
If you want to do more of them, they're simple.
Since your election, have any other big-name pro wrestlers contacted you for advice about running for political office? Whom among your former wrestling colleagues have you heard from since your election? And a related question, Hulk Hogan is now rumored to be considering running for public office in California. What advice would you give him should he enter politics?
Well, first of all, I've spoken to no wrestlers since I won. I'm very disappointed in the world of wrestling and how they treated me during this, and I say this very seriously because I gave 15 to 20 years of my life to the business, And they came to Minnesota, the WCW, the Atlanta group, with Hogan last June. And I went down there feeling that if anywhere I could get support, right, this would be the place to do it. It was sold out at the Target Center. When I went down there, they purposely would not show me on television. They did not introduce me to the crowd in any manner. And I will tell you very honestly, it hurt. Personally, it hurt. Because, as I said, I gave my heart and soul to the world of wrestling for a number of years. And so because of what happened there, I didn't refer to wrestling at all in my inaugural address, and I had no wrestlers or anyone in wrestling who came to my inauguration. Because remember something, and I see one of my SEAL brothers out here, we have a saying in the SEALs, we don't get mad, we get even. And and as far as wrestlers running for office, well, look at it this way. We got certainly enough lawyers there, and look what they've done. I don't think the wrestlers could do any worse. But in all seriousness, the greatness of our country, why would being a wrestler have any bearing on running for public office, as I spoke to earlier? It's our forefathers made this so simple because they wanted us all, I think, inherently to be qualified to be public servants and serve in public office. As far as Hogan running in California, I'll make the same statement. Shouldn't he have to live there? He lives in Florida. If he wants to run for office, run where you live. Don't run for what's convenient. And besides, with him, it's simply, you know, he has a large ego. And he's the richest wrestler. He's the most famous wrestler. But I am now the wrestler with the most credibility, and it eats away at him.
You mentioned that you know, you're not looking for the money from lobbyists, and you ran on really on a shoestring. But you had name recognition that really no one else would have. $400,000 might be enough for you to get elected in Minnesota, but in a state, large state like Florida or Texas or California, it would take 40 to 50 times as much. How do you suggest that people who are not well known, who are not celebrities, run for office, or is this just going to be celebrities get elected?
Wrestle. No. First of all, my name recognition wasn't the highest in the state of Minnesota for this election. Hubert H. Skip Humphrey III had the highest name recognition according to the polls, not me. So I was number two, apparently. But yes, I was a unique situation, and it did afford me a terrific advantage, I guess, in having the name recognition. And maybe someone else can't do it. I don't know. I can't answer the question whether someone else can do it. But I think what it does tell me is that in order for someone else to do it, we need campaign finance reform, and we need it badly. And people will disagree with me. And I am a capitalist, rest assured I am, because I've always worked hard in capitalism. But my personal belief is it's the one place you'll see me take a socialist view. I feel that if you have achieved major party status and whatever criteria that takes to get there, I think that each candidate should get public financing equal amounts of money and let them spend it the way they see fit. But let's do it that mechanism rather than selling our soul to rock and roll as we do now, of going out and begging and pleading. And I'll continue. We're doing something right now that is unique. They don't know what to do with it in the campaign finance area. And we're having to go in front of these boards to determine what we're doing, if we can do it. We're hoping, if I run again, to totally finance my campaign through merchandising. No one's ever did it before. Selling those dolls, selling those T-shirts. But think about it a moment. What's a cleaner way to get money? Me turning to you and say, give me $50, or selling you a T-shirt where you buy it and the profits are used to support my campaign. It's a nonprofit corporation that we've formed. I get no money out of it. Some of the money will be donated to charitable cause, and we're hoping to get a ruling from ethics that we can use the rest of the money to finance a campaign. So I will continue to break new ground and set new standards in the political world.
Have several related questions here. In your opinion, what is the foremost difference between the two established parties and the Reform Party? And do you consider your administration a test for the Reform Party?
I think, again, the major difference between my party and the two major parties is the fact that you have to adapt to the parties, the Democrats and Republicans. You have to get into their narrow scope, as I say, the 15% right, 15% left. And you have to adapt to that, whereas the Reform Party is far more wide open. We, I feel, have a much broader base for ideas in allowing you to be yourself and run on who you are and the ideas that you stand for, rather than to be channeled into partisan party politics and caucuses. I mean, we're to the point now where elected Republicans and Democrats, at least in Minnesota, I notice, can't even really and truly vote their own conscience. They have to go back to their party caucus and get approval to make sure that they're, you know, voting the way the caucus and the party wants them to vote, because woe be if you lost that party support next time you wanted to run. And that's the problem that I see there. As far as am I, what was the second half to that question?
Are you a test?
For the Reform Party? Maybe. I don't know. You know, many people have wanted me to take a leadership role nationally in the Reform Party, and I will take that role supporting. But I have a job to do. I'm the head executive of the state of Minnesota right now, and that is the main focus of my job. It is not party building. Party building must be left to the heads of the party to do that. My job is to focus and ensure the state of Minnesota runs as best I can.
A couple of other similar questions. Is your election a shot across the bow of the two parties that the electorate is tired of high-spending, heavily spun candidates who don't say what they mean and mean what they say? And based on the response to you, do you believe issues such as campaign finance reform have more resonance with voters outside of Washington? How do you see yourself as a wedge into the two-party system?
Well, I'll answer the second one first. I think everything's different outside of Washington. Boo. They are. I got word. You guys in the Beltway don't have a clue. Geez, now you made me forget the questions again. I get rolling here.
Based on the response, do you see yourself as a wedge? Do you believe that issues such as campaign finance reform and other issues are what's on people's minds?
I
shot across the bow of the two parties.
I think so, in a way. I think I was a wake-up call to them. If I'm not a wake-up call to them, I think they're going to suffer more losses. That if they don't wake up to the fact that people are concerned about the real issues going on out there, and that if they don't wake up to the fact that they're there to serve the public, they're not there in their quest for power and their quest for party power and all that. They're there to do the public's bidding. And I think that it is a shot across the bow a little bit to them because of the fact that, again, I'm getting so much press, and again, I've had people state that my election is the most important election that's happened in America in the last 50 years, and I'm flattered to hear that if that is considered true. But I hope, I really do, that the two parties do wake up and that they do come with a more centrist position of doing what most Americans want done in this country.
Governor, before I ask the next question, I want to point out that in our audience is fellow Minnesotan artist Leroy Neiman. Pleased to have you with us. Governor, you've already referred to the possibility that you might run for a second term, but you've also been quoted as saying that you don't hold jobs long. After you leave the governorship, do you plan to run for Congress, or is there another house that you're looking at?
Well, the one I looked at last night looked pretty nice. It's got real high ceilings, very spacious, The antique work and the woodwork is remarkable. A lot of history to it, too, that particular home. But, no, in all seriousness, I may run. I'll decide in 3 years whether I run for governor again. I know there's been a lot of press. Will he run for president and all of this? No, I will not. Not in the year 2000. Because one of my biggest criticisms of my Republican opponent, Mayor Coleman, was the fact that he had just run for mayor and won in the city of St. Paul, and then he turned around in less than a year and started running for governor. And I didn't like that at all, because that to me is not fulfilling your commitment. And I made a commitment to the state of Minnesota that I wanted to be their governor for 4 years, so therefore I will do 4 years as governor of the state of Minnesota. But 2004, well, who knows? I could end up down the street here in that big white house, or I could end up living in a hut on the beaches of Kona where I would throw my watch away and know that when the sun comes up in the morning, you get up. When it's straight overhead, you eat lunch. When it goes down, you go to bed. And so I don't know right now what my future holds. I'm just going to do the job that I'm doing right now, and as I've done in all my life, we'll see what happens when a new day arises.
I have a couple of questions that are related. Let me ask this one, and I think it'll cover them. You are frequently the subject of parodies by Garrison Keillor. How has that affected your attitude towards state funding for Minnesota Public Radio? And after being a radio personality, how can you even consider getting rid of public radio?
Well, let me tell you, first of all, Garrison had nothing to do with it. It's something that I've thought about for quite some time, having worked in radio. How can I do it? Right now, Minnesota Public Radio gets 2% of their budget from the government. 98% of their budget is already paid for through their fundraising mechanisms. When public radio began, it was not government supported. Somehow it got on the public trough. And I ask you, we've had welfare to work. That seems to be the trend throughout the world right now, or the United States, welfare to work. What about corporate welfare to work? I mean, it's only 2% of their budget. 2%, and yet everyone throws their arms up and says, oh my God, public radio is going to fold. Well, I don't know of any corporations that lose 2% and fold if they've still got 98% bringing money in. And for the people that criticize me on that, they're getting ready to have a big rebate from the government. Whether it comes, I hope it's a sales tax rebate, my proposal, but it's going to be fairly large and a good size money, and I've told them, if you feel inclined, sign your rebate check and send it to public radio. Not me, my check. The amazing thing, and let me say this, is that everyone tells you cut government, cut spending, cut taxes, and then when you go to do it, it's, well, yeah, cut everybody else but mine. Well, we all have to tighten the belt buckle by a notch if we're going to accomplish that mission. And it has to be uniformly across the board. We all have to make sacrifices if we're going to cut taxes because of the fact, again, government does not create $1 of revenue. But the chances are if they're going to give this a dollar, they have to take that dollar from somewhere else. And the chances are they took $2 because they kept one as holding or finance fees before they pass on the other dollar. And so my point on public radio is I'm not axing them off, I'm weaning them off. I'm letting them know well ahead of time that it's time for them to stand on their own 2 feet. Corporate welfare to work, if you want to call it that. And Garrison Keillor has nothing to do with it.
You talked about the budget surplus in Minnesota, but Minnesota did not have a multi-trillion dollar debt like our country does. Which do you favor for the federal surplus, tax cuts or reducing the federal debt?
Well, I hadn't really thought about it. That's the federal government. I think I leave that to Mr. Clinton, but President Clinton. But Having not studied it, I truly haven't, because I've been neck deep in getting my own budget out and naming 24 commissioners and putting in about a 10 to 12 hour workday on the state of Minnesota. I certainly enjoy paying less taxes personally, but and I can't really answer that without studying it more and knowing what the repercussions would be on both sides of the issue on whether to cut taxes or what, put it to the national debt. Is that what they, well, I don't know, that might be a waste. I don't think that debt's ever going to go away. I don't even know how big it is now.
This is a Minnesota question. The state of Minnesota has a history of being in the forefront of vigorous enforcement of antitrust laws. Can we expect this to continue under your leadership?
Whether we're vigorous or not, I really don't know, but I certainly do support antitrust laws. I don't think anyone should have a monopoly. I think when we work in a capitalist society with free markets, we have to make it fair and equitable to everyone to be able to compete in those markets.
What steps are you taking to keep the Minnesota education system strong, and how will you organize state resources to assist single mothers attempting to obtain higher educations?
That was a loaded question, wasn't it? And I guess after my thing on the steps of the Capitol, somehow government's responsible for those decisions, right? What have I done for education? I'll tell you what I've done. In my budget right now, it's rising only 2.9% per year for the biennium, which is far lower than my predecessor and one of the lowest budgets in state of Minnesota history, in the fact that average family income is expected to rise around 4.5%. So we're well under the rise in average family income, which means that's a tax cut in itself because people will keep more money. But in all of my new spending over, I think it is, right, but I'm thinking of money. Was it $586 million? I believe it's $586 million, and 70% of all my new spending is directed directly at education. So I am not forsaking education in any manner. Education is the key to our future. As far as, and I know what this question pertains to, the confrontation I had with the college students on the steps when it dealt with single mothers going to college and getting their tuition cut and all that, and I made the statement, I said, well, why did you become a mother before you got educated? And what I mean by that is very simply is plan. And if you make a mistake in life, how is that somehow onto the government, that we are to rectify mistakes you've made? I mean, I have sympathy, but it's called personal responsibility also. And I got hissed over that, and then I was told, well, the guy ran off. Well, is that my fault you married a bum? I mean, you know, that was a person, if this jerk runs off, sure, we'll try to hunt him down and bring him back and make him pay. But I mean, again, people must learn, and that's what I'm trying to expound to the younger generation, those young people that voted for me, is the fact, be self-sufficient. Don't look to the government when you make a mistake. Pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, correct the mistake, and in the long run, you'll be better off for it because you'll keep a core sense of values. It's like my son right now. God bless him, and I love him. He's 19 years old. He's a beautiful kid. But you know what I learned from raising him? When I give him something, he doesn't take care of it. Dad gave it to me. Big deal. Now he's working, putting in about 55, 60 hours a week. He's earning money, and he buys things for himself. My goodness, you should see how he takes care of it. Don't touch that. He's got special spots for the things he buys. Everything is taken care of now. Why? Because he paid a price to get it, didn't he? It wasn't handed to him. He got a core set of values that you have to sacrifice on one hand to get something on the other hand.
I have two related drug questions. Do you have plans to reform the drug laws in Minnesota? If so, how? And should nonviolent drug offenders fill up the scarce prison cells? Should they even be arrested?
Well, First of all, I think prison cells should definitely be for violent prisoners, and because those are the ones that are committing acts of violence against other humans, and those are the ones that need to be taken off our streets to make them safe. As far as drug offenders goes, in a lot of ways, I lump this into one of my core values that I'm sending out, not teaching, I'm not a teacher, but as I give it to my staff and the people, my core values, and one of those is that you can't legislate stupidity. And I'm very clear on that. And it's not just in the drug world, it's in many worlds. Government today, every time someone does something stupid, they come back and want to legislate and make a law. Stop people from doing stupid things. Can't be done, ladies and gentlemen. Up in Minnesota every year, and I'll get to the drug stuff in a moment. Up in Minnesota every year, we have snowmobilers and frozen lakes. And every springtime, we'll get about 5 or 6 days of nice warm weather, and a snowmobiler will decide to drive out onto the frozen lake. And he'll go through, and he'll drown, and it's tragic. But again, that's legislating stupidity. How stupid must you be to go on a lake when you've had 5 days of 70-degree weather on ice? Not smart, but we can't legislate that. As far as drugs go, my mother, God bless her, lived through prohibition of alcohol, and she told me that the war right now on drugs is the same as the prohibition of alcohol was when she went through that as a young person. And I believe very strongly that in order to conquer a war on drugs, it's simple. You have to stop the demand. That's the key to it. Stop the demand and the supply will dry up. It's no different than right now if I wanted to buy a 50 caliber machine gun. Rest assured, if I've got enough money, someone's got one. If I got the dough, somebody has one out there. The same thing holds true, and as far as the drugs go, my goodness, we have drugs in Stillwater State Prison. These people are locked up 24 hours a day. If we can't keep them out of the prison, how are we going to stop it out in the free world on a street corner? So I think, in my viewpoint, we need to take a new approach to the war on drugs. We need to look at educating people, again, that stupidity is not the right avenue to go down, get our young people to make good choices, and the only way you're going to defeat this war is by defeating the demand for it, not the supply of it.
Governor, we're almost finished, but before I ask the last question or so, I'd like to present you with a coveted National Press Club mug.
Okay.
And a certificate of appreciation suitable for framing.
Thank you. I'll have a good line for you, too, in a second.
All right. I have two unrelated questions, which will be our last. But before I ask those, I would like to remind everyone to please, when the program is finished, please remain seated until we can get the governor and Mrs. Ventura out of the room. So please remain seated. Which is more fun, being a Rolling Stone bodyguard or the governor of Minnesota? And what do you want your legacy to be?
More fun is being the governor, because when I was simply a bodyguard for the Rolling Stones, I had to work that night. As governor, I just got to go and have fun and listen. So it's more fun being the governor. Plus, as the bodyguard, you don't meet him on this even ground as you do as the governor. What was the second half to that again? What do I want my legacy to be? I really don't worry about that, but I think if I truly wanted a legacy, I would just have the people of Minnesota simply say, you know what, he did the best job he could. He gave it 100%, and that's what I'd want my legacy to be. I want to thank you very much for the mug, but I have to bring up something in Minnesota. Is this under $5?
For you it is.
Well, because it's gotten that ridiculous now, we in Minnesota are not allowed to take anything over $5, which I think's absurd because it borders on rudeness. It does. I mean, if somebody brings you in and offers to break bread with you, which is a natural thing I think we all do, if someone, you have to turn them down. I'm sorry, I can't take that. How rude. So that's one thing I'm going to work on. I don't think any influence could be bought for 50, you know, when we're dealing. you know, raise it up to 50. But I can honestly tell you that I can accept this, and I can accept anything else, because it also says if you're a keynote speaker, you can take whatever they give you in recognition of your speaking. But that's the way it works down in Minnesota. If you're going to eat somewhere, you got to make sure you're going to talk. Otherwise, you don't get whatever it is they're going to give you. But thank you very much.
Thank you.